Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Ken Ray, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce the second plenarist of the day, Dr. Paul Newman. I could easily fill up this entire period talking about Paul's many accomplishments, awards, and accolades, but I know you want to hear from Paul rather than from me, so I'll try to keep this relatively brief. Paul Newman is widely viewed as one of the most influential African linguists of our day. He's the founder of modern comparative Chadic linguistics, and he's the world's authority on Hausa. He is, by any measure, a linguist. Paul has held academic positions in the United States, Nigeria, and the Netherlands. He's the author or editor of 18 books and over 100 articles and reviews. Most of us here, I'm sure, know and have probably read linguistic fieldwork compiled and edited by Paul and Martha Ratliff. Paul was the founding editor of the Journal of African Linguistics, and he served on the editorial boards of Language, Current Anthropology, Studies in African Linguistics, and Anthropological Linguistics. He's also, I'm proud to say, an active member of the editorial board of the journal Language Documentation and Conservation, which is published by the University of Hawaii Press. As if all of this weren't enough, Paul also has a law degree and currently serves as counsel to the Linguistic Society of America. Let me add on a more personal level that I've always found Paul to be a provider of useful and constructive advice. He's an original thinker, and over the course of four decades, he's given a great deal of thought to the subject of linguistic fieldwork. Consequently, I'm very much looking forward to hearing his presentation today entitled, Linguistic Fieldwork is a Scientific Enterprise. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Newman.
Ken, thank you for that gracious introduction. I'd like to thank Ken, Nick Teeberger, and particularly Jim Yoshioka, the organizers of this conference, for having put together such an incredible event. And I'm particularly pleased that they gave me the opportunity to talk to you today about a topic that, dear to my heart, linguistic fieldwork, which in some ways one could argue almost is tangential to some of the interests of people doing language documentation, but I really don't think so. I think that it is a central matter. Before I get into the talk, I just want to give you a little anecdote or story, if I may, and that has to do with this book that Martha Ratliff and I edited, Linguistic Fieldwork. Go out and buy it. I get royalties. You know. Actually, we give them away, the LSA, but... The interesting story about this book is that the idea of a book of essays on the personal nature of fieldwork came up when I was a member of the LSA Endangered Languages Committee, and a few of us were discussing matters of this or that, and the idea came up, this was discussions with Nancy Dorian and Tony Woodbury and some others, is why don't we put out a book so that students and other people have some idea of what fieldworkers do. You know, we sort of have some idea, and they figure you go out in the field and you have dirty feet and dirty fingernails, but what do field workers actually do? And so I thought, this is a great idea, and it's, well, who's going to do it? And everybody pointed their finger at everyone else, and somehow or other it ended up on me that I would do this. So I said, well, this is a great idea, a wonderful idea for books, and I contacted a number of publishers, and there were no bites. Not even a little. This was 1997, and none of the publishers were interested. They said, well, who is interested in field work? The book will not sell. And I said, well, I've lined up a few minor figures in linguistics. So Ken Hale, you know, Marion Methuen, Karen Rice, Larry Hyman, among the Africanists. I've got top people lined up, and the publishers all said, yeah, nice idea, no thanks. Fortunately, and this we all learned from field work, what really matters is who you know. I had a close personal friend, Jessica Cooper, who was the anthropology editor at Cambridge University Press, and she took on the project and sort of pushed it through, and so here is the book. You think of that reaction in 1997 and look around this room today, and I think the only line is Bob Dylan's, which is, times they are a-changing. I think this is really true. And I look at the beautiful setting for this, and I think, you know, 40 years or so of wandering in the theoretical linguistic desert, and finally we've discovered the Garden of Eden. That's the way I feel today. So I think we should thank the organizers for this. This positive attitude is great, and I don't want to put a wet blanket on things, but I feel that if field work and documentation of languages is going to be productive and earn the respect of linguists in general, we need to inspect what we are doing a bit more closely to see if it makes any sense. And that's what I'd like to do today, is to look at what I call three major movements involving linguistic field work, raise some questions about their assumptions, and provide a critique of their approaches. The three movements are, one, the endangered languages movement, two, the language documentation program, and three, what I call the traditional orthodox approach. First, start with the endangered languages movement, and it goes without saying that without endangered languages, we wouldn't be here today. I think this is very, very clear. The resurgence of interest in fieldwork comes out of the endangered languages movement. You can date it if you want to put a date, 1991 with a paper by the book by Robins and Uhlenbeck, or probably as far as reaching the linguistic community, the 1992 paper in language with Michael Krauss and Ken Hale and so on. And with the resurgence of interest in endangered languages has followed the interest in fieldwork. This, by the way, was not obviously so. I gave a paper a few years after the 1992 paper called The Endangered Languages as a Hopeless Cause. You know, and the point of my paper was people are going to sit around a room and cry, but nobody's going to go out and do anything. I was wrong. And you know, it's great as a scholar to be happy that you are wrong. I'm seldom happy I'm wrong. I'm usually trying to be right. But this has had a tremendous impact. I don't think I have to talk about the importance of the endangered languages movement, what it's accomplished, but let me just focus on three positives just to give background. First, the subject of the field of linguistics is not just language with a capital L, but languages. What makes our field exciting and challenging and important is language diversity, the wealth of languages spoken by real people and differing greatly from one another. We are finally breaking the idiocy of the past 50 years when the view of testing a linguistic hypothesis went something like this. Let's check this thing. Let's pick a language at random, whereupon someone in the room would say, how about English? Second contribution of endangered languages is the need to learn about the variety of languages of the world entails finding linguists who will do it. And people who have the drive, the interest, the motivation, and the skill to do the work on these languages. And the third, sort of, we won't call high-level contribution of the endangered languages movement, is an awareness there that there are both moral and scientific issues involved. You can't just ignore one or the other. And that when you talk about the loss of languages and cultures, there are human, social, moral issues, and there are scientific issues. Fine, that's the good things. How about a critique? What do we want to, if we look at the endangered languages movement, there are certain things where it's not beyond criticism, and let me point out some of the problems with some of the assumptions that are held by what we'll call the endangered languages folks. I'll find my pages. First, we've got a is the assumption that working on an endangered language is better than working on a non-endangered language. Is this necessarily true? I'm not so sure. If a student came to me and said, I'd like to work on this language, and I'd say, why? And the student says, it's endangered. I would say, that's a great seventh reason. Now, what are reasons 1 through 6 for wanting to work on that language? And I think there's an issue that so often is not discussed, which is, what is the basis upon which we as scholars choose languages we want to work on? And one of the reasons I think this slips by is the whole tradition in field methods classes in universities where that decision is made for the students before they get there. There's a certain sense in which the field methods course is a failure the first day because the hard job is figuring out what to work on and why. So there are all kinds of factors that you want to think about in deciding to work on a language. For example, what do you hope to learn from the language? Now, I know this is a bit heretical to say because in Linguistics 1 or 101 or whatever it's called at your university, we're supposed to say that all languages are equal. You know, as a scholar, I don't believe that. There's some languages that are more interesting than others in some respects. We're not going to talk about the whole language, but if you're really interested in tone, you don't want to work on a language that doesn't have tone. That's pretty straightforward. If you're interested in serial verbs, work in a language that has serial verbs. So that one of the things you want to do is find a language that you're going to learn something. Second is the ability to do efficient, productive research. In the case of an endangered language, Christian Lehmann said, languages need to be alive enough for the research to meet minimum standards. Moribund languages and seriously endangered languages probably have gone too far to be worth documenting. I'm not sure it's entirely true, but it's certainly something you have to keep in mind, which is the language viable such that you will get some good scientific information out of it? How about the availability of good informants? Something which is critical. How many informants? Are they good? What are your opportunities to learn to speak the language? And this really depends on how viable the community is. Are you welcome? Or better still, are you wanted? I mean, the greatest thing about going to do research is to work where people want you there, right? Are you wanted by the community? Are you wanted by the government, right? Are you wanted by native scholars in the country who may not welcome this American or Brit or German or whatever it is who all of a sudden decides, I'm going to go out there and make such and such my language? How about the availability of infrastructure? Accessibility of electricity, gasoline, research stations. If there's an archaeological site nearby where there's an infrastructure and somebody there who can fix your equipment when it breaks down. Funding opportunities, political stability, and your own skills and interests. Some people, I mentioned tone, and didn't mention this, but I was a master's student here in Hawaii some years back in the anthropology department. And I put myself through school riding around this island tuning pianos. I was like, well, to me, tone is easy. But syntax, I can barely, say subject, verb, object. I mean, for me, that's tough. So different linguists have different skills. And in thinking about what language you want to work on, you want to keep those things in mind. About an endangered language. If you're a graduate student, should you work in an endangered language? Terry Crowley says it's tougher to work in an endangered language, and he thought that it would be morally unacceptable for a supervisor to send a graduate student out to work in an endangered language. You can argue, agree or disagree, but it's certainly something to keep in mind. What is your facility in relevant foreign languages? Access to the research literature. If you're going to work in Cameroon and old materials, do you read German? Right? How about the lingua franca of the area? Do you speak Portuguese or Hindi or Swahili? And there are all kinds of other things. And then finally, deciding a language, there are personal matters. For example, if you can't swim, don't go to work among some group where they get around on canoes that are going to be turning over. All right? If you don't know how to ride a horse, I'll tell you my horse experiences. No, I won't. Anyway, if you don't know how to ride a horse, try to stay away from people who ride horses, and factors such as food. If you're Jewish or Muslim, don't go somewhere where the major source of food is pork. So it's amazing these things that people just ignore. A colleague of mine said, picking a language is really easy. Three essentials. The weather is lovely, the food is delicious, and the women are beautiful. Assumption number two, excuse me the sexist thing, but you know, okay. Assumption number two is working on an undescribed language is better than working on an already described language. Everybody says, of course. Right? You're going to go out there, you're going to work on this language, somebody's already worked on it, when there's this one that's never been worked on before? I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure at all. That one can get deeper and into more interesting aspects of a language when you can build on previous work, when you can stand on somebody else's shoulders. In a paper by Emin Bach, he commented that a couple of things struck him about languages. One is how much they're all the same, and two is how much different they are. All right? And in many cases, they're the same in the surface, the very shallow, the easy stuff, and the differences come out later when you start digging into a language. Or even if a language has been studied, chances are there may be a grammar, but there's no dictionary, at least nothing that would be worth, you know, calling a dictionary. Or if they have a dictionary, it's not very good, or it's not very big. From a scientific point of view, I would say it's better to have two good descriptions than two dozen shallow descriptions. And there's another benefit of working on languages that have been studied, which is that you have somebody else to talk to. Right? This is not trivial. Now, one of the things I think we miss in linguistics, in many cases, people go out in the field, sort of the Lone Ranger approach to field work, is that not just the personal problems, but the intellectual stimulation. The colleague who can turn to you and say, why did you say that? Didn't seem right to me based on what I found. And even better nowadays is the fact that there are linguists who are native speakers of the languages you work on. And this is a real benefit that you often miss working on small languages. Assumption three, the endangered language tragedy compels a sense of urgency and panic. And Bowen, in a wonderful book that just came out in 2008, says, in working on an endangered language, you should record as much good quality data as possible, even if you do not have time to analyze it. Himmelmann, 2008, says, with regard to the economy of research resources, it may be more productive to spend more time on expanding the corpus of primary data rather than to use it for writing a descriptive language, a descriptive grammar. And the reason is because the feeling, I got to go fast, I'm worried, okay. That there is this sort of moral imperative. But my feeling is a moral imperative and a panicky approach is no excuse for bad research. Besides, in most cases, the language is not going away tomorrow. Now, we want it to sound that way when we apply to the Hans Rausing Fund for, you know, to get some money to go into the field. You know. But in reality, in most cases, well, there are some few exceptions where there's one old person still managing. But in most cases, the language is not going away tomorrow. In many cases, what we mean by endangered languages is languages where the long-term or even intermediate-term prospects are not good, and it's something that we were concerned about. But it doesn't mean that it's not going to be there tomorrow or next week. And if it were true that the language were truly threatened, that they were really like, this is it, you've got, you know, 3 months, then you don't send out one sole linguist, you know, on his or her own to do the job. You say, if it's important enough, you send out a team and you say, this is what we're going to do, here's our chance, and let's do it right. This idea of you got to do it fast, to me, is a trap for the unwary. One wants efficient research where quality is equally important as quantity. And what this means is that analysis and ongoing preparation of research while one is in the field must be done. As a rule of thumb, I would say, as I teach my students, is a field linguist needs a minimum of 2 hours analysis for every contact hour while you're in the field. Now, this admittedly requires self-discipline. The temptation for all of us field linguists is to take advantage of the time we have in the field to work with the people and amass data. But I would contend this is bad science. And although it may seem paradoxical, I would contend that if you spend more time on analysis and less collecting, you're actually going to end up with more data, not less data. Part two, if you're following this on my minimalist handout. Part two, language documentation. A language documentation, as you all know, is a lasting, multi-purpose record of a language. The goal is to provide a framework for recording little-known or previously known unrecorded languages. Most of these languages are endangered. And I think, again, we can appreciate the positives that have been brought to us by the language documentation program. For example, first is the idea that data collection is not trivial. Christian Lehmann wrote, as in any empirical science, a basic step in any linguistic work devoted to a language is the collection of data. And he notes the low prestige of data collection and so on. Many years ago, there was a classic paper by Noam Chomsky where he talked about various levels of analysis, and he talked about the level of mere observational adequacy. And I say, anybody who calls observational adequacy of a language that hasn't been described mere has never done field work. And so I think one of the important contributions of the language documentation movement is the focus on the real problems of and the techniques and the skills and the professionalism involved in getting basic data, whether you want to call it raw data or primary data, but getting the basic data, and that this is not something just is an annoying thing that you got to get out of the way so you can get to a more serious task of contemplating the navel or whatever. Second contribution has to do with archiving and sharing, which is a matter of making one's material available to other scholars is important now and in the future. And I think all of us, certainly people of my generation, can tell you the innumerable colleagues we know, all of whom have large quantities of data in their bottom drawer somewhere, collecting dust that some widow is going to have to worry about years later, and in the meantime, it is of no use to anybody else. And I think the notion that this is something that one wants to think about in the early stages, not something that you think you do your field research, you collect your data, and then 25 years later, then you worry about, well, what am I going to do with it? I think as early as possible, you want to make things available. And this raises problems. For example, a few years ago, I have a colleague, worked in a language called Kotoko, spoken up in northern Cameroon. I did some work on Kotoko years ago, and my feeling was, I'm never going to do it. I want to share my materials with my colleague. There's a problem, which is that I used Hausa as my contact language, and therefore all of my translations and notes are in Hausa. Now, the target language was Kotoko, but my contact language was Hausa. And my colleague, like most people, doesn't speak Hausa. And so I don't know what you do about it, but I didn't think about it at the time because I assumed the material is for me to work on only, and it never occurred to me what's going to happen, how am I going to be able to share these materials. Third contribution is that there is no excuse nowadays for not having good audio and visual record of one's field research. We can all tell stories about linguists who spent a year in the field at considerable expense. You know, you got to fly there, and you got to live there, and you got this and that. And then they come back with crappy tape recordings made on a cheap machine they bought at Kmart. I can't tell you the number of times you see this. It is embarrassing. So I think it's something that we have to say is think of this record as important and something that we want to take into account. Having said the good things, I'm of the opinion that the basic program of the language documentation people is fundamentally unsound. Now, I learned this morning that a lot of what I'm saying now is misunderstanding and misrepresentation, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway, so at least you can get a different perspective on it. Number one, the objectives are absurdly demanding. The idea that you're going to go and do the entire language, whatever that is, everything about the language, including the pragmatics and the semantics and the sociolinguistics. And we've got to do the kinship. And I guess we might as well do the DNA to find out about relationship. This is too broad. Who's kidding? And I love the point of view where someone wrote about this, you know, the narrow scope but essential contribution of the linguists who do grammars, dictionaries, and texts. That's narrow scope. Right? I mean, why? Because the person didn't somehow or other, you know, figure this out. How many lifetimes does anyone going to have to do all of this? Anvita Abi wrote, her approach is quite general, but she says, no grammar is complete unless it tells us about how the language is used as a vehicle for social interaction. Great, would love it, but can't do it. And Bill Bright talks about, you know, the goal of anthropological linguistics is the description of languages within the context of their particular cultures. In this view, the ideal grammar would not only account for the internal facts about the structure of a language, but also for the connections to non-linguistic cultural context. And then Bright, who had a lot of sense, said, it's hard to imagine how such a very large grammar could be written or published in anyone's lifetime. And if providing everything that any linguist might want to know is not enough, the goal of language documentation is also to ensure that the primary data should be available to other interested parties, whoever they might be, such as folklorists, ethnobotanists, etc., etc. I think the answer is you do what you can. You can't do the impossible. Critique number two, the objectives are not demanding enough. What is being proposed, I think, in terms of language documentation is a quick fix response to field work based on the fallacy that I mentioned above about the need for to do this urgent work. Right? So the claim is that people want to do more than grammar, text, dictionary, but actually they're doing less because they're giving up grammars, texts, and dictionaries. Right? And this is a case where by trying to do too much, people end up doing too little. I also think there's much too much emphasis on texts. This is a peculiar idea of mine, that I think texts are the return on the amount of work you put into publishing texts is very, very small. Don't anybody here throw stones at me, but I'll talk about this a bit later. The language documentation approach has the delusion that data are being collected with the idea that somebody else, not necessarily the linguist himself or herself, at some other time, we don't know when, might be interested in what one brings back from the field. And I think the only term here is one that Christian Lehmann used and colleague Nicholas Himmelmann also used, which is data cemeteries, data graveyards. That is really what language documentation is about. Okay. Of course, doing a good description takes time, but there's no reason to give it up. You do the best you can, you achieve what you can, but you don't totally capitulate and say, I can't do the good things because, you know, I can't do everything. And Nick Evans, in a review, had a wonderful quote from Voltaire, which is, le mieux est l'ennemi du bien. The best is the enemy of the good. And I think that's, think about that. All right. Critique number three, what I call the missing how-to. And from what I can see, no one's ever actually told you how you go out and do language documentation. And especially how you're going to record all of this. There's such an emphasis on, although I was surprised this morning, Professor Himmelmann is here, that he sort of backtracked on the importance of technology, but I assume that an essential component of language documentation is audio and visual recordings. And who's training anyone how to do this? One of, to me, the most striking things about this very interesting book, Essentials of Language Documentation, just came out, edited by Himmelmann and Gibbert, is that there is no chapter on technology. And there's a footnote saying, we don't have a chapter or a comment, we don't have a chapter on technology because it's handled elsewhere. It's not handled elsewhere. No one has told you how to go out in the field and do good recordings. Okay? There are a lot of problems if you're going to do proper professional recording. First thing, who's going to schlep all the equipment, right? What does it cost? Who's trained to operate it? Who's authorized to operate it? How about repairs? What do you do if the equipment falls in the river? If you're in Nigeria, what do you do if you're in an auto accident? What do you do about backup? What do you do about security? What are your electricity needs? What are your power needs? To do professional quality sound and video recording that is wanted and desired, field linguists would need the skills and trainings held by professional sound engineers and cameramen. And we don't have those skills. How does one make, and it's, Peter Austin says, you know, every recording should be high quality, absolutely high quality, and authentic. Now, I don't know where he's done his work in the field, but in mine, you got a choice. You can do high quality recordings, or you can do authentic recordings with the kids screaming and the crows crowing or whatever it is. You don't get them both. But good cameramen can do a lot of that. How do you know how to do that? How about videos? How do you do videos at night? No one talks about this. But a lot of talk is at night, folks. We know, in fact, a lot of people, that's most of the time they're talking during the day till they're working. It's at night when people talk. We don't know how to record them. So one is expected to do this. No one tells you how to do it. No one tells you how to learn it. And to my way of thinking, it makes the whole enterprise unattainable, wishful thinking. Four, critique. And this is unfair, but I'm going to say it anyway. Which is, I think that the approach trivializes linguists and informants. That there is no real involvement of linguists, no real concern about the skills and aptitude of linguists, and no real mention of the skills and aptitude of native speakers in the enterprise. Right? There's no mention of learning to speak the language under study. These are, to me, all huge failings. As Nick Evans comments, that the language documentation program requires that people carrying out the documentation be experts on so many things they would have to be masters of the universe to do it. The one thing that people apparently are not supposed to be are linguists. And I'm not going to mention the person by name who said this because it's so absurd, but someone says, well, you know, it's actually not a bad idea for people to know some linguistics if you're going to do language documentation. But that's easy to learn how to do because there are good books at hand. For example, Hockett, 1958. Hockett, 1958? This, to me, this statement speaks volumes about the true nature of language documentation and its total disconnect with linguistics as a scientific discipline. And worse still, there's no appreciation of the importance of good informants. There's lip service to the idea that community should be involved. But in fact, I think it's totally ignored. The documentation program is really in the spirit of documentary filming and recording a la the Nature Channel on public television, where a big, well-financed crew with fancy tents, hopefully a lot of booze, shows up in a community for a few weeks of intensive recording and then gets the hell out. This is a National Geographic approach to exotic cultures. Keep the equipment clean and running and do all of one's recording from a proper distance so as to avoid germs and mosquitoes. Ironically, language documentation emerged out of concerns of the endangered languages movement, which takes a moral high road and places a high value on professional ethics and responsibility. But to me, the language documentation agenda is neocolonialism at its worst. I'm not being recorded saying this, am I? Okay. Five, who's supposed to do this? PhD students are supposed to go out and collect data so that somebody else down the road is going to analyze it? How are they going to get a PhD dissertation out of this vacuous, unfocused work? And mid-career linguists, presumably who have active research programs, obviously not. Who's so magnanimous that they would just go out and do this? I can't imagine. Six, where's the linguistics? And to me, the major weakness of the language documentation program is what is missing is research. Right? Himmelmann, 2006. The core of a language documentation consists of a corpus of audio or video recordings of more or less naturally occurring communicative events. Peter Austin, for language documentation, then, data collection, representation, and diffusion is the main research goal, with grammars, dictionaries, and text collections as secondary dependent products. Wow. The notion that one is supposed to record in the field and somehow, who knows whom, is going to analyze the materials later is nonsense. As Christian Lehmann says, good documentation itself requires the addition of interpretative information, I guess going from raw data to primary data, which not inherent in the data, but generated by the author of the documentation. In real research, there's a relationship between data collection and analysis. As colleague Larry Hyman said, fieldwork is analysis. What language documentation program is proposing is something which to me is incredibly anti-intellectual. It is butterfly collecting. And if there are any butterfly collecting, I don't want to knock you, but anyway. The mere collection and reproduction of raw data is not a scientific activity. To me, it is a far cry from real linguistics. Well, it's a bit harsh, but fortunately, there are enough of you here who do language documents that you can defend yourself. So, part three, the traditional orthodox approach. In the handout, in the abstract on the book that was published, it's called the Bob Dixon approach. It is associated with the work that Bob Dixon in Australia has done, but I think it's not limited. It's the kind of approach that us old-fashioned kind of linguists, whether it was Ken Hale or I think even Karen Rice or Michael Krauss or people like myself, Sasha Eichenwald, do. And it's not really a coherent program as such, but rather sort of what we can take as the unstated assumptions of field linguists over the past 10, 20, 30, 40 years. I think we can say that Dixon has set a standard to emulate as being a field linguist who was attuned to major issues in general linguistics and was able to bridge the unfortunate gap that existed for so many years between field linguists and theoretical linguists. It is precisely because of Dixon's stature and the fact that he's been outspoken in his views, he's less shy than I am when it comes to being outspoken, that when he says something, one has to take it seriously, and when he says something silly, one has to say that it's silly. He is never wishy-washy in his views, and so when he's wrong, we can see so. So let me sort of talk about this. But first is the positives, right? Dixon defines field work as going into a community where a language is spoken, collecting data from fluent native speakers, analyzing the data, and providing a comprehensive description consisting of grammars, texts, and dictionaries. And what I love is that all of these things, such as analysis, writing, publishing, are listed under field work. Kind of interesting, one sees it as a total program. To put it another way, if the acronym LD&C, Language Documentation and Conservation, were not already taken, then it could be used as a label to represent our traditional approach, which was language description and communication. Positives of this approach. One, the extreme importance of primary fieldwork as a component of linguistics. So in that sense, shares what the others have said. Two, the interdependency of fieldwork and broader issues in linguistic theory, typology. One doesn't want to be tied up with some trendy theoretical fad, but fieldwork as part of linguistics is very much incorporated and depends upon the insights and contribution of theory and the questions being raised by theory. Three, the centrality of comprehensive grammars and dictionaries as opposed to studies of specialized topics that happen to be of interest at that particular moment. And four, the importance of getting one's materials analyzed and written up promptly so that they're communicated and made available to others. Problems. One, what is fieldwork? Some people talk about different things. Field work simply means collecting data where the language is spoken. Right? And then people say a study which is not based on real field work, meaning where the language is spoken, will run the risk of obscuring or distorting the basic characteristics of the language. Dixon, by far the best place to study a language is in a community in which it is spoken, observing how the speakers live and how they use the language. And Crowley sort of makes a distinction between dirty feet linguists and at-home linguists. Sasha Eichenwald talks about immersion in the field versus informant work in one's office. All right. So we have this contrast between, quote, real field work and pseudo field work, FF, faux field work. All right. But I think that people have been missing the boat, which is that they're not just two categories. There's a climb. There's a range of things that could go under the term field work. For example, we can start with real prototypical field work. You know, this is the kind where you're like the anthropologist and you go out there and supposedly you speak the language, although we are now learning after many years that most anthropologists never learn the language, they just pretend to. Or you do it, if not in the local language, in some local lingua franca. Or another one is being in the host country, but being in a nearby town, not in the community itself. This is very common. Many times people go to the field, oh man, I was with so-and-so, but you discovered they were in this little town nearby where there was, if not electricity, maybe running water, if not running water, at least a cleaner place to stay. And so that they were close to the site, but not actually in it. Or in the host country, but in a major town. People go and they're in Nairobi. You know, I was in the field. I was working on Turkana. Where were you? I was in Nairobi. Well, actually, Gerrit Dimmendahl, former student of mine, was up in Turkana country. But it is not uncommon. People go and they say, I'm in the field, and they are in Bangkok, Nairobi, somewhere else. Where else? Working in the country, but, for example, at a university. This is an opportunity a person has to get to the field. They get a Fulbright or they get a grant. This is great. I can go there, so I'm in the field. But they're not in the field. They're at the university. But then they said, you know, I've spent the year in the field. Working in the country, but in kind of special places. For example, and this is, I think, totally neglected by lots of field workers, which is orthopedic hospitals. They're wonderful places to do work because you've got people in there who have nothing but time on their hands. Right? And you want to come in and you say, there are speakers, and I'm going to do a language survey, and there's speakers of 50 different languages in there. And in many cases, and I say orthopedic rather than some other kind of hospitals, you know, you want to avoid the germs. But, you know, is that not field work? How about in your own country, which is to say, working on Hausa communities in Hamburg or Oromos in Minneapolis? I mean, nowadays, there are communities, or Hmong in Chicago, there are communities of people, and they are communities, it's just they've been displaced. And then finally, in your own office. Okay. By adhering to the fiction that only anthropological type immersion research qualifies as real field work and is worth talking about, one neglects, A, the potential of these other kinds of field work, which, by the way, if we get real, have been a source of valuable descriptive studies. Even if they weren't ideal, lots of the studies that we depend on were done under these kinds of situations. But even more important is by not talking about sort of treating these things as unspeakable, these other kinds of faux field work, is we neglect looking into the issue of how does one do that field work better? Instead of saying, we're not going to talk about it, say, we'll talk about it, but let's find a way to make that kind of field work better so that if that's what you're going to do, at least do it more effectively instead of saying, I'm just going to try to take the techniques that might be working in a community and transfer them. Okay, next question. Why do field work? In a recent paper, Bob Dixon gives two and only two answers. I don't know whether he was purposely being provocative, let's say he was pulling our leg, or whether he was being serious, in which case he obviously wasn't thinking when he was writing. But here's his two reasons. One reason to do field work is to learn linguistics. I guess that's one way, you know, punish people and say learn by doing. Certainly a sort of a rite of passage. You send them out there, if they come back alive, then you'll get the PhD. And then the second reason to do field work is personal intellectual pleasure. You enjoy it, all right? Or as Bill Samron said, and by the way, so it's not just Dixon, you know, recently, this is Samron back, whoever knows when, is field work is characterized in one word, at least for me, it is fun. Well, this may say why some people are drawn to linguistics, but the fact is that there have been lots of field linguists who, if they were honest, would tell you that their field work was stressful, unpleasant, maybe not torture, but far from fun. The pleasure principle is neither a necessary nor sufficient condition of why you should do field work. And Dixon says, if you undertake field work for any other reason than for its own sake, you're doing it for the wrong reason. And here, let me just mention two of the wrong reasons. One wrong reason is going to the field to test and prove a linguistic hypothesis. That, for him, is a no-no. I thought that's what science was about, was testing hypotheses. You got ideas, and you say, there will be no language in the world that has implosives and ejectives at the same position of articulation, and you've heard about some community that has this thing, the language has it, and you say, let me check it out. You go there and say, you know, the hypothesis was right or wrong, but the notion that you don't check things out, that this is not a valid reason for going to the field, is crazy. And then he says, one should not undertake field work simply because the linguist feels they have a social responsibility to document the language before it disappears. That's a bad reason to do field work. Well, as I mentioned before, I don't think that's the only reason, and I think you need other reasons. But why is that so bad? Why is that bad as a motivation, if that is what encourages you to get off your rear end instead of, you know, sitting at the desk and going out and saying, I don't have to do another optimality account explaining what we already knew already. You know, why don't we go out and do some real work? And if your motivation is endangered languages, then I say, go for it. That's great. And I think there are people who agree with me. And I'll give a quote. It is a task of the utmost importance to provide documentation of as many languages as possible before they disappear. And one more quote. The most important task in linguistics today, indeed, the only really important task, is to get out on the field and describe languages why this can still be done. Two quotes from Bob Dixon. Okay, so why do field work? And the answer is, as a scientist, the response is very simple. One does field work because one hopes to learn something. Right? One wants to find answers to questions. One wants to solve interesting problems. And ultimately, it doesn't matter what motivates you to go into the field, whether it's your first experience or your fifth project. What is important is that the linguist has the personal and professional wherewithal to do the job well and make sure to carry out the work according to the highest professional and ethical principles. The whole language fallacy. Sasha Eichenwald says, another type of malpractice, oh, I like that word, being a lawyer, you know. Another type of malpractice involves working on just one aspect of a language without taking account of the language as a whole. And so I can show off, you know, a quote from Meillet, you know, that every language is un système où tout soutient, a system where everything holds together. It's a famous statement by Meillet, and everybody quotes it. And as Dixon says, every part of a language description is equally important, and each part interrelates with the other. You can't do one without the other. But of course you can. You've been doing it for a long time. Of course you can. You can do syntax using standard orthography without knowing anything about the allophones of the phonemes. One can sort out the noun plural morphology without understanding the pragmatics of their use. One can figure out the operation of a vowel harmony system without understanding the semantics of the kinship terminology. Now, of course, we linguists are sometimes caught by surprise, and something comes up where we say, whoops, you know, I overlooked that. The key to this phonological problem was this morphological alternation. But that's the nature of science. You don't know in advance what's going to be relevant. But the notion that you have to know it all is silly. Linguists should work on what interests them and what they're good at. If someone wants to do a comprehensive grammar, a broad scope, covering a whole language, I was just crazy enough, I did a grammar of 800 pages, which, by the way, Bob Dixon didn't like. But there's nothing wrong with that. But there's also nothing wrong with doing a detailed study of one aspect of a language. There's no a priori reason to rule it out. For example, in the Chadic language family, which I work on, there's a language called Tongale that Mike Kensowitz did research on that has a cross-height type vowel harmonies, kind of a vowel harmony system one finds in Ghana and so on. It's the only Chadic of 140 Chadic languages. It's the only one that has this type of vowel harmony system, and there are no other languages around it that have it. Someone said to me, what are you going to work on? I say, go work on vowel harmony in Tongale. Right? Do you need to do plurational verbs in Tongale? Not necessary. Do you need to do that? No. Do you need to do gender? No. Why does it have this? No, we don't know where the key and the answer is going to be, but there is something where you say that is something crying out for research. Number four, the grammar text dictionary imperative. And as we talked about in terms of doing the whole language, why must everybody do a grammar, a text, and a dictionary? Again, do what you're good at. I won't spend a lot of time on this. I just will say this about texts, is texts are now fad, you know, part of what you're supposed to do is record text, which is fine, collect them, transcribe them. And if you ever read the estimates on how much time it takes to transcribe text, it's off the wall. I mean, it really is. Some people say, for every minute, you need an hour. 1 minute recording, you need an hour. And it's sort of like, somebody else says it's 20 to 1. There was one I read, it was like 9,000 to 1. I mean, how long it takes, we don't know. But transcribing text is a job, right? And one of the things we find is the law of diminishing returns sets in fairly soon. That once you have done 30 pages of text, the next 30 don't teach you as much. And the next 30 teach you even less. And by the time you get to the next 30, unless you know you're a glutton for punishment, you wonder why you're doing it. The reason to do text is not for posterity. There's no one in the right mind that's going to get a collection of texts on some language they don't know and work through those texts and write a grammar or do an analysis. I haven't seen people doing it. Everybody's collecting texts, Archives of the Languages of the World in Indiana. It's got loads of stuff. I've never yet seen a book that's by someone that says, I wrote my grammar based on going through those texts that Carl Vogelin collected. No one's doing it. So we're just kidding ourselves. There is a reason to do texts, and that is as a research tool. You use text as a research tool because it is what opens up what you don't know, it what confirms what you think you do know, it raises all kinds of questions, and you can learn a tremendous amount working with text in the field, not putting down for some kind of archive. If there's anything worse than a data cemetery, I think it's a text cemetery. Okay, so now we're down to grammars and dictionaries. We got rid of the text. And again, in reality is, not everybody does grammar and dictionary. Go to the library. And if there's still shelved here by some kind of Dewey Decimal number, and you'll find the grammar of so-and-so, and then look to the book right next to it. Is it the dictionary of so-and-so? And you go, gee, it's missing. Maybe it's been checked out. All right? Or it's done in 1885, or maybe hadn't quite done it yet. The fact is that there are many less dictionaries done of exotic languages, less commonly taught languages, minor languages, languages we don't know, undescribed languages, described languages, what have you, is that people don't do good dictionaries. What you get is a serious grammar and then a word list. And some promise that, you know, eventually I'm going to do it, which never really happens. One of the reasons why is, and I Did you teach a lexicography fieldwork course at the Institute? Is that people don't talk about it. They don't talk about lexicography and what is really involved in doing it in the field. Lexicographic work is time-consuming, labor-intensive, if I could say it, boring work most of the time. And so to do good dictionaries is you've got to work. It doesn't happen as an afterthought. You've got to work on it. I would suggest, and I don't know if anybody else has suggested this, but it's worth a try, is send somebody to the field, a student work on a previously undescribed language, and say, do the dictionary first and the grammar later. Do the dictionary. Collect words. And for every word, make sure you get examples. Have people create examples. Get examples from text and so on. But the work from the dictionary. And then do the semantics, and then do the pragmatics, and have the dictionary expand, and it'll be amazing how much you will learn about the language. And I would almost to the point where if you had a big dictionary, the grammar would almost write itself. And you learn so much in dictionaries. We worked on the dictionary of Hausa, and we'd do some words, and we'd ask someone, could you sort of give me an idea of sort of how exactly the connotations of this word, how does it work? And the person said, well, Kilu Aliyu, in his poem so-and-so, used it in line this and that. And Hausa people know poetry. And time again, they would give an example of a word beyond the simple denotatum that we know, but showing the expressiveness of words because they knew literature and poetry that we didn't command. So it's worth a lot. Okay. Five. The expletive deleted method. There's a comedian, stand-up comic, a man of some ability by the name of George Carlin. I don't know how many of you are George Carlin fans, but for those of you who don't know American culture, George Carlin is best known for a wonderful monologue he gave some years ago, which was on the seven dirty words. And these are the seven words that you can't say in public, and certainly not on radio or TV. And it was on the radio, and then he got arrested, and then they had a lawsuit, and went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's a wonderful, wonderful case. I won't say any of those words. I'm of a different generation. But rest assured that they have to do with excretory functions, sex and body parts, and they're primarily good Anglo-Saxon monosyllabic words. So, okay, so we'll leave it at that. Now, many of us in the traditional field methods world, that we're liberated and we're not bothered, and people like Dixon, I don't think he's a blues expert, I don't think he's bothered by the George Carlin words, but there is one word that we gotta watch out for. And I don't know, you're cheering whether I can say it in public. Okay, well. Elicitation. Ooh, that's a bad. And not only is it bad, but unlike good, macho words like the George Carlin words, this is five syllables. Elicitation. You know, it must have been invented by some French linguist. All right. You cannot believe, and I didn't know this myself, I'm doing the research for this paper, is people's reaction to the idea of elicitation as a means of field work. It's not the way to understand what a language is like. Elicitation should play no role whatsoever in linguistic fieldwork. And so on and so forth. And even the people who say, well, if you're in a jam, use elicitation, all apologize. Right? Well, I know. Don't expect to be reliable. It's all wrong. People are going to lie to you or who knows what. But somehow or other, elicitation is a text, that's a good word. Monosyllabic, by the way. But elicitation. Ooh, what's wrong with elicitation? And I think this objection and rejection of elicitation as a field technique apart from the fact that it's the stupid way that we did field methods courses for years and people saying, God, I remember I took that course and it almost made me hate linguistics and become a taxi driver or something. But I think it's based on two fallacies. First is somehow the notion that what you're looking for are automatic discovery procedures, that your methodology is supposed to ensure good results. This is not the way that science works. You want efficient techniques. You want techniques that are not going to be totally cockeyed. But the issue is not whether these procedures are automatically going to give you the right answer, whether elicitations are going to give you the right answer or the wrong answer. Is the key to field work and the key to research comes from verification, double-checking, repetition at different times and different places, and the most important of all, refutability. That you come up with observations, you record things, and if another linguist goes, this person is going to find something the same or similar, and if not, and it doesn't matter whether you took it from a text or whether you elicited, all right? The real answer is you do what works. Both Bowen and Anvita Abhi, when talking about how to do phonology, they both say what you do is you start out with very narrow transcription, you get it all down, and then later you do like, you know, we finish with Hockett, and now we can have, we can have Nida or whatever it is, or Pike, is you start with a narrow transcription, and then you don't, you look for minimal pairs, and then eventually you move to a broad transcription. Okay, I think that's utterly cockeyed. I think the way to do phonology is you start out with a broad transcription. Right? When I teach field methods, I have my students do the phonemic analysis of the language they're going to work on the week before they come to class when they've never heard the language. All right? You have your working hypothesis because it's only later, when you're familiar with the language, you're in tune to it, that you're going to hear all this stuff. Right? You can't be there and ask an informant to repeat the word 18 times where you're trying to hear, is it a dental or is it an alveolar? But who cares? It doesn't matter. Whether you follow their method or you follow my method is if you are a serious linguist, if you check what you're doing, if you verify what you're doing, if you don't believe that the first thing that somebody says is the truth, you're going to come out with the right answer. And so, same with elicitation. Elicitation will reinforce what you find in text, and text will reinforce what you find in elicitation. There's nothing bad. But there's even another reason. I've lost the end of my paper. Well, I'm going to do this by memory. All right. Oh, no, I found it. The other reason is that I think people have a very distorted notion of what elicitation is. This sort of idea that all this involves is asking the informant to translate a sentence from the from your language into the target language. But that's not what elicitation has to be. That's one thing you can do. But elicitation includes translation, back translation, manipulating data, grammaticality judgments, asking questions about sentences found in text, using stimulus tools, pictures and so on, semi-structured interviews, questionnaires. And I would even say asking informants for simple questions such as, how do you form plurals in your language? Or, how many genders do you have, and how do you know when one word one belongs to one gender rather than the other? Wacko to do it that way, but why not? Right? And I think the main problem with the scholars who downplay the importance of elicitation is that they're not taking advantage of the linguistic smarts and intuitions of the native speakers, and the effort that is involved and the gain that you get by training your informants, some of whom are remarkably perspicacious. When I was working on Terra, I had a super informant who had an incredible feeling for the language, sharp insights, and I would say things, and he'd say, have you thought of looking at it this way? I said, well, no. He said, well, I'll try. Okay. And Bob Dixon, in his wonderful book, 1984 book, talks about an informant woman named Chloe, who he said was a natural linguist. Given the proper educational opportunity, she could well have been doing my job. And I think it's sort of ironic with regard to this matter of informants is that whereas most field workers have switched to the politically correct term consultant, they still treat their speakers as mindless corpus-producing machines rather than as active participants in the research program. Next, technology. How much more time do I have? 5 minutes? Okay, coming toward the end. I'm right toward the end. The correct thing about technology is that it has to be seen as an accessory and not as an end in itself. All right? That technology is not going to guarantee good results, and lack of technology is not going to guarantee no results. I think there is a simple rule which is called garbage in, garbage out. And sometimes machines simply allow a bad linguist to do bad research more effectively. All right. So that we understand, that we want to be a bit skeptical of technology, but I think that we have to get over this business of being afraid of technology, and the next generation, fortunately, is not. Is, of course, these things are incredibly useful as research tools. You know, Dixon might say, well, all right, the computer is great. When I go back from the field, I can write up things. But it is wonderful in the field because while you're there, you can organize data. You can collect things. You do a dictionary. You can sort in various ways. You can retrieve in various ways. And that this is something that is just really, really, you know, sort of incredible what you can do with technology. So it's not a cure-all, but it's important. Oh, excuse me a minute. Talking about technology. Oh. Okay, well, sorry. It's one of my informants from Nigeria. This thing is potentially the most valuable technological contribution to fieldwork that has ever been invented, and nobody talks about it. It is totally overlooked what the cell phone can do for our Argentina. Never talked about because I'm sure somebody has and I haven't read it. But I think it's neglected. It does a lot of things. It enables a linguist from the West, let's say, to be out in the field and keep in touch back home. It enables you while you're in the field to track down informants who didn't show up that morning for one reason or another, something I'm sure none of you ever had that experience. It allows you to, once you come back, is to keep in contact with people. And to me, I'm sure this is different in different parts of the world, but in Nigeria, you can go out in very remote, small villages and small communities, and people have their cell phones. You can check things. And I think this is something that we all have to take into account. In conclusion, this is an exciting time for linguists who appreciate the value of fieldwork and have been attracted to the idea of doing it. Fieldwork is finally achieving a degree of recognition and appreciation within linguistics, and funding opportunities exist now that one never would have dreamed of 25 years ago. Part of the progress and change has come from the enthusiasm, dedication, and encouragement of scholars, such as many of the other speakers of this conference, some of whom I disagree on with small points, but for whom we have a debt of gratitude for the way this field has grown up and become exciting. To be honest, and I have a confession to make, and I didn't want to make it earlier because they might not have invited me and I wanted to come. I never told the organizers this. I never thought of myself as a particularly talented or effective field worker, or someone with a burning desire to be frustrated and uncomfortable. I managed to do a credible job in the field, which in my case has meant going back a number of times, written grammars of the various sizes of three languages and so on, because of hard work, self-discipline, strong motivation, and I think really important, a coherent research agenda. And not because I had any natural aptitude for fieldwork. However, having been involved in fieldwork for so long and having thought about it for a long time and having discussed the matter with colleagues who are good field workers, I think that I have a good sense of what works and what doesn't. That is to say, I don't expect you to accept Everything that I've said today is the absolute truth, but I hope that you will think about the issues that I have raised, and that once you've digested the essence of this overly long talk, that you will find that many of the ideas to be well-founded, to have thought about things in linguistics, and will lead to an effective, methodologically sound fieldwork approach that deserves to be called linguistics, and linguistics, as we know, is the scientific study of language. Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. Please use the microphone.
Thank you, Paul, for that. Is this on?
Yes.
Hello.
Yeah.
It's on.
Okay. For that informative and provocative lecture, as always, I thought you were getting mellow, but I was just wondering if I could add to the kind of criticism that you made. To me, this is one of the more fundamental ones. As linguists, especially since the publication of Dorian's book in 1989, and thereafter, Netto and Romain and others, we have been so gung-ho on doing linguistic documentation for the purposes of avoiding or maintaining language and keeping them from being endangered. But it is not so clear to me that we understand that documenting languages alone is not sufficient for them to maintain vitality. Because we have seen cases where languages that had been documented for a long time ago, Gaelic being one of them, and we can name several others, that have become sort of essentially museum pieces. I think the colleague who spoke this morning about American Indian languages in Canada brought that point. I think he used the term pickle. So you're not going to revitalize languages by simply documenting them and making dictionaries and reference grammars unless somehow we can be realistic to think of the policy application of that kind of result. These languages will remain, in some sense, museum pieces, just like old Latin that is no longer spoken, except maybe at the Papacy in Rome. But here we have it. I think that this is an issue that we have to address in terms of why do we want to do this, not only that, but how can we necessarily maintain the languages in the sense of providing vitality to otherwise moribund or likely
more languages. Thank you, Ayamba. I'm going to be very brief because I've had my say. Just very quickly, I think the endangered languages movement, since its inception, has had the two prongs. One is the idea of supporting, encouraging revitalization of languages, and the other is, in some ways, the notion that they're gone. The writing is on the wall. And before they're gone, let's document it. So I think in some ways, it's not as if the documentation really, in many cases, is not part of the revitalization program. As the linguist either says, I'm going to be a linguistic engineer and see what I can do about helping revitalize the language, or the person that says, I'm going to be a scholar and say, there's nothing we can do, but at least we can preserve it for posterity, for the generation of the community itself, and for the community of linguists.
Thank you, Paul. I really enjoyed the food for thought, and I wanted to rise to some of the bait that you dangled in there. The one I'm particularly thinking of is the missing know-how. Where do you go to learn how to do this? And I think many of the other, let's say it's not hard to find incendiary comments or things that are easy to criticize as you look through what any large community of people has produced. There are outliers everywhere. if you come to something like the Infield 2008 that Carol Giannetti
right.
and a bunch of us put together in Santa Barbara, or in 2010 when we're going to do it at the University of Oregon, I think you'll find a good mix of know-how and a community of people who are really trying to figure out how to address a lot of those issues. And I thank you for raising them, and I would love to see you come join us and try to figure out how to answer them.
You're so right. I mean, it's not that we're not trying and that it will happen. It just hasn't really been done yet with a thought of how does this fit in with the program. In many cases, and someone I think asked this morning, does language documentation, is it a field by itself or does it belong in linguistics? And as long as it's within linguistics, then the professional pressures on graduate students and faculty to do a particular kind of linguistic work is going to sort of always have this kind of documentary work as secondary, and therefore it's going to be hard to get the kind of training. But it ought to be there, and I'm sure, I'm an optimist, it's going to happen. Thank you very much. As far as some of the statements, I mean, clearly reality has to set in, and that you can have ideals and goals of how you want a program to be, and then if people are going to go into the field, they're going to have to do things differently. As I say, I was thinking about not giving my paper this afternoon because many of the things that I was planning to say when I listened to Nicholas this morning, I said, now I'm starting to agree with you. But this is not what I read. For the past month, and my wife will tell you, I'm coming up the stairs saying, you can't believe this. You can't believe what this person said. So I think there is a lot of that in the literature that maybe I'm not the one who's being provocative. I think unknowingly and unintentionally, I think a lot of the statements and pronouncements on the part of the language documentation program have been much more doctrinaire and rigid than they intended. And clearly, once people start turning this into practice, it's not going to be that way. It can't be. But if you don't want to go ahead anyway.
Can I just say one more? Okay.
Yeah.
The ideological part of me is having a heart attack. Because a lot of the positive things that you've said, and I thank you for them. But the practical part of me that's been sort of sloshing around in the Amazon with mosquitoes for the last 15 years was so grateful to you. Because so many of these things do end up unspoken, and the expectations that we set for ourselves optimistically and with that sense of hope and optimism, it sometimes just really doesn't work out that way. And so I think it's really important to have this discussion and start speaking those unspeakables, because We need the ideas and the ideology and the abstractions. And then we need the mud and the mosquito bites and the actual, like, you know, putting the rubber against the road. And so this is very fruitful and very helpful. And sometimes polemics really can shake us up a little bit in the way that's necessary. So I'd like to thank you, even though I'm pretty irritated.
Well, as my colleague Yamba said, I used to be provocative. I've mellowed in my old age.
Thank you very much, Paul. Okay.